You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
The story of the UK is an economy that has got real momentum.
What is broken can be repaired. What is ruined can be rebuilt.
UK inflation is becoming much more homegrown.
We have huge potential as an economy in the UK.
This is a time to tell Israel there is a path to peace.
Our plan for the British economy is working, but the work is not done.
You're listening to Bloomberg UK Politics. I'm Ewan Potts.
And I'm Stephen Carroll. Welcome to the programme. At the risk of you consigning me, Ewan, to Curmudgeon's Corner, I'm sort of increasingly finding myself in this position where the internet being an equally wonderful and frankly terrible place, all of the options that we have to have, you know, as much information as we want at our fingertips. But what's important perhaps doesn't get enough attention. There's a question, too, of how information is disseminated online, too. But we're talking about this in the context of the risks of disinformation affecting the world's big year of elections. That's something, of course, that's bad, but also something wonderful that we found on the internet.
Yeah, if you think British election coverage is a little bit dull sometimes, personally I live for it obviously, then you might want to take a look at South Korean TV. Their election graphics have been causing a bit of a storm on social media. Koreans have just been electing their new parliament and they've been able to watch candidates start in what I think you could probably say is rather non-traditional political TV, including a romantic melodrama and even a rap battle.
Yeah, I mean, this is a fairly impressive feat of television or broadcasting that, of course, brought to us by the internet, both interesting and educational. Trying to imagine how this would transpose onto a UK election night. Would we have, you know, Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer playing soccer, maybe? Cricket?
Yeah, I'm sure the BBC will take this up. I can just see it, you know, Jeremy Vine.
It's time to remake Pride and Prejudice again. This is how we could do it.
That'd be rather fun.
Yeah, or you know, other comedy duos are available as well. But then, you know, this is all part of a battle, obviously, for attention, which makes it more difficult, as I'm saying, to get perhaps some of those important election issues and airing for them and eyeballs for them, particularly when so much of this is kind of disseminated online. The flip side of this, though, is while it's amazing that you can superimpose politicians' faces onto all sorts of scenarios, it also presents the questions of things like AI-generated deepfakes.
Yeah, I mean, we've been talking about this for some time, haven't we? I remember back in not the last US election, but the one before that, 2016, we were already talking about fake news, and the threat has been ramping up. And of course, AI has been so much in the news over the last year, so much processing power going into that and ramping up in technology. It's interesting to think how much is that's going to be a threat in the rest of the elections we have this year, the UK, the US, India, and many other democracies. We've been hearing from social media giant Meta on these risks today. It owns Facebook, Instagram, and WhatsApp, of course. And Nick Clegg, remember him, is their head of global affairs. He told an event in London that it's striking how little artificial intelligence is being used to disrupt the many elections around the world. He says he's quietly optimistic about the technology sector agreeing on standards for moderating AI-generated media. Well, joining us to discuss this is Bloomberg's technology reporter, Mark Bergen. Mark, is Nick Clegg right on this? Should we all relax about the risk from AI in the elections coming up?
I think the only way to answer that accurately would be just to get inside Facebook's data and Meta's information, and I don't think they've, as far as I know, they haven't disclosed that. I think you know, this is I wouldn't be surprised if this is something that perhaps Meta and other platforms will have to disclose, similar to hate speech, and kind of classifications like hate speech, child sexual content. You know, these are things that regulators in Europe and the US have kind of forced them disclose, and there's sort of agreed upon standards. I think that, you know, Nick Clegg mentioned a lot that he sees a lot of progress on the industry and regulators sort of agreeing on not just defining what is AI generated content and perhaps disclosing that. But again, it's really unclear how Meta defines what is, in his terms, an actual systemic disruption of elections.
And you talk about disclosure, but do you think that the tech giants, Meta included, have got any idea of how much stuff is out there? Do they know, if you said to them, please disclose this, would that be a simple operation, or are they clueless about the problem as well?
I don't say they were clueless about the problem. I think it's something similar to, we could take hate speech as an example, right? That, you know, Meta has its own sort of working definition of that, and then I can say we've seen, you know, X percentage of hate speech on Instagram, and you know, his comments, Nick's comments yesterday were, you know, that number's dropped to a fraction of a percent, in part because, you know, he's saying that, you know, there's all this concern about AI, but the reason that we're able to eliminate so much hate speech is because of AI, and because of advances in AI that Meta is able to cut out the hate speech appearing on Facebook and Instagram. This is something similar to what Google has said, and I think, you know, both companies historically have pointed to this proportionality example, right? They're saying, you know, it's a tiny percentage of our overall content on our platforms. The reminder here is just how massive that overall content is, like how many people post on Instagram and Facebook every single day around the world in dozens of languages. And so at that scale, I think that's something that the company, you know, they often point to these numbers because it looks really good for them. But if you actually point out this sort of tangible amount of content being produced by AI, that could be an enormous sum.
If we look at that example of how these platforms have tried to address hate speech as well, do we get the impression that they do respond to pressure from regulators when governments sound the alarm, or perhaps independent watchdogs sound the alarm about this being a problem, that they do react to it?
So that was, I believe it was last week that Meta came out and said they're now going to be labeling any AI-generated content on their platform, not just created something by, but the tools. Like, Meta's put out a bunch of their own AI tools for making images, and now they're saying if there's another tool that's produced by AI and it appears on your Facebook feed or Instagram, it's going to be labeled sort of, this is an AI-generated image. I think that's certainly a response to both regulators, to their advertisers, that, again, a reminder, their business is basically solely reliant on advertisers. Advertisers have no interest in seeing, like, a deep fake, you know, their... This problem has happened in prior elections where you have misinformation, disinformation, this political content basically appearing next to an ad. And so I think that, you know, they're certainly responding to regulators. I'd say they're probably responding to their primary clients more so.
How likely are Meta and the other players to be able to meaningfully control this stuff? Because they always talk about the number of staff involved, and they have thousands of staff working on this kind of on these safety issues, don't they?
Again, that number's gone up significantly since, you know, 2016, 2017. A lot of that is always kind of contracted labor. You could certainly make the argument that that's probably not an adequate amount of people, given, you know, Clegg mentioned this yesterday, the election that had in Indonesia, an upcoming election in India, where you have more than 20 languages spoken, and WhatsApp and Facebook have been vectors of misinformation. I think the companies themselves probably would admit that they can never get a handle on this, in part because it's a political problem and an intractable one. I do think, you know, they're under a lot less scrutiny than this is not the, partly because they changed their name, but this is not the Facebook of 5 years ago, where they were constantly in the heat. And I think some of that is just that policies, regulators in the world have kind of moved on a little bit. I think some of it probably is in the resources that they put on kind of content moderation and trust are much more significant than they were in years past.
Is this something that we're seeing any sort of coordination across the industry to try and tackle? Is there, you know, sort of meetings happening at high levels among executives? Because we talk about Meta because they're such obviously the massive player in social media, but there are other companies that, you know, we watch for this area as well.
Yeah, I think the bigger other platform here is Google. You know, that obviously has kind of search, and then YouTube, you know, Microsoft to a certain extent. TikTok is obviously a big and important player in this, and I think they're you know, that'll be really interesting. Obviously, like in the U.S., TikTok is now being threatening that ban, I think, which has thrown a total wrench in this idea of like all the platforms agreeing on and kind of sitting at the table.
Mark, thank you so much for joining us. That's Mark Bergen, our technology reporter. I actually reported a deep fake online a few weeks ago. It wasn't a political one. It was someone else, a public figure, and it was clearly fake. And they rebuffed me and said my complaint wasn't valid.
Oh. So,
I won't say which company did that, but I wasn't very impressed.
Well, let's get another point of view now. We're joined by Keegan McBride from the Oxford Internet Institute, who specialises in digital government, digital innovation and the use of AI in the public sector. Keegan, great to have you with us on the programme. We were just hearing there from our technology report about some of the industry commentary around the use of artificial intelligence. I wonder what have you made of those comments that we've heard from Nick Clegg of Meta, that, you know, the major elections so far this year haven't had a significant problem with malign use of artificial intelligence?
What I would say is it doesn't surprise me. Myself and a bunch of my colleagues here at the Oxford Internet Institute have been saying this sort of since the launch of GPT-3, that a lot of these fears over misinformation are probably a little bit overblown. In fact, one of my colleagues wrote a paper called exactly that, misinformation concerns are overblown. So yeah, not really surprised in the slightest. If you think about AI, what are the concerns? What might it do in elections? People will talk about generating misinformation, that it'll be somehow used to create this content that looks realistic, that, you know, significantly disrupts things. But that's happening without AI in a way, or, you know, like AI isn't doing anything sort of like fundamentally new that will have some sort of unprecedented impact compared to what's already happening. And I think this is sort of often forgotten, that we already have a lot of issues when it comes to these threats, and AI and what it can do isn't really amplifying any of them per se.
Do we need to make a distinction between misinformation and disinformation here? Because I accept that your colleague's research has been looking at misinformation, but those who are trying to deliberately mislead, is that a separate issue, or are we seeing the same sort of trend in both?
I mean, I think academics will certainly tell you that there's a difference between the two. I don't really myself get caught up into the sort of nitty-gritty of the distinctions. But I mean, let me just give you an example from the United States, right? So data brokers will sort of publicly say that they have 3,000 data points on every voting age American. So that's 3,000 data points times 200-ish million people. They are going to be already using all of this to craft campaigns, to craft messages. They're going to be running advertisements. They are then going to be, you know, running these advertisements through focus groups 10, 20, 30, 40 times until they have crafted these messages that they think will influence the voters who sort of matter the most. That's all happening. That's all legal. That's, you know, being done without AI. It's incredibly effective. If you think about AI, it's like, yes, it could be used to generate information at a scale that we haven't seen before. But that information has to have a, you know, like a target. People need to be consuming it. We already know that there isn't necessarily a large market for this. You know, there are conspiracy theories, but whether or not they're super impactful on the broader results of elections is probably, you know, minimal, that impact. So the quantity being created is probably not going to matter so much. Then you could get into debates around quality, but once again, it depends on people actually wanting to consume it. And it doesn't seem to be the case that there's enough people who are consuming the sort of specifically crafted information, you know, at a scale that will somehow significantly disrupt elections or ruin democratic processes. And then the third thing that my colleague would talk about is also, you know, about this personalization. So we had fears in the past over Cambridge Analytica about sort of hyper-personalized advertisements. As I've already said, this is already possible without AI. Theoretically, you could use AI to sort of improve this process, but research coming out now does seem to show that it's probably not as effective as some folks think. Now, what I would say is that these impacts are, of course, going to probably differ between different political contexts. You know, democracies with stronger institutions will probably have a better job at, you know, pushing back against some of these things. But I haven't seen anything yet that shows AI is somehow going to fundamentally erode our democratic elections or processes. And in fact, at Oxford, we're running in an elections initiative this year, which is covering the digital aspects of all of these elections. And from what I have seen and from what I have heard, this impact has been quite minimal thus far.
So there's a huge amount of data out there. How much should we be worried about should be worried about the threat from malign actors in Russia and China and elsewhere, to that data itself, and just more widely in terms of misinformation?
This is, of course, the truth, right? Like, if you did want to think about how actors would be able to get the sort of biggest bang for the buck, we're talking about, you know, targeted spear phishing campaigns where they're using AI to generate realistic, videos, voice clips, and so on, to sort of like impact a specific individual or a small specific group of individuals. That is probably where you will see, if you are to see an impact of an AI on an election, that is where you will see it. But once again, there are more efficient and more effective ways for doing it. Of course, sort of authoritarian aligned actors are doing this. We know that China was doing this in the recent Taiwan elections. We have seen these attempts, but they will do that with or without AI.
Can you give us an idea of how this technology might evolve and the sort of examples of things people might see in social media, for example, that would be AI generated content that could be relative to an election?
Anything that tries to sort of alter how you perceive a candidate, because even if you can prove that an image was sort of generated by AI, some of the sort of underlying assumptions that come attached to this might still be there. Sometimes you might see potentially sort of a little bit of getting tired in a way of having to disprove things. And I think this is where you run into a lot of interesting questions around the need for sort of, verifying true original content, because it's one thing to say that this is not true. It's another thing to say that this is true, this is realistic. And if you are, let's say, a female candidate, and absolutely women probably are going to have a harder time with this. And we've seen this play out already with sort of like, non-consensual AI generated sexual images and so on. You're going to have to sit there and say basically every day, this isn't me, this isn't me, this isn't me, this isn't me. And that gets tiring over time. So I could theoretically see some sort of, threats and things happening in that regard. But I haven't seen that out in the wild yet at a super impactful scale.
What's your take on the state of regulation of big tech at the moment? Obviously, the EU has passed the landmark legislation on AI. The UK recently passed the Online Safety Act, not specifically for AI. Do you think that governments around the world have got a grip on this?
There are calls that are finding support across the aisle to sort of look into breaking up some of these monopolies. There are questions around, obviously, their role in sort of providing the platform to spread content that may or may not be true, misinformation, hate speech, and whatever have you. But what I would say also is that I think folks tend to forget that big tech actually does have a vested interest in keeping a lot of this stuff off their platforms. So Google, as an example, has done quite a lot of work in sort of securing elections. They do a lot of preemptive work in, letting let's say political candidates, if they're being targeted by nation state actors, they can help to sort of defend against some of this. They can try to fend off cyber attacks against elections. And they've been doing this for a long time. Similarly, after the Cambridge Analytica scandal broke out, you had a lot of agreement around, not allowing sort of political advertisements, trying to cut back against misinformation, disinformation. And I would say that they are trying to do a good job, and it's somewhat important to not ignore that. But obviously, there's room to, improve how these sort of large corporations are being handled regulatorily, just due to the sort of nature of their ability to influence global affairs.
Well, I wonder what your view is of how the UK can affect this as well, because this is, of course, we've had the Online Safety Summit hosted by the UK government as well. The UK government has stated its objective that, not only wants to get the opportunities from AI, but it also wants the, to be able to put guardrails on it. How is this country placed in the ability to do anything about this?
So I think one thing that's going on is that everybody is caught up in the sort of hype around next generation foundation models, frontier models, whatever you want to call them. But basically, we're talking about, cloud and ChatGPT and these sorts of advanced AI-based systems. And in focusing only on these, the government and to be honest, the world has sort of ignored a lot of the different sort of methods that we have for creating value from AI that have been used and are still being used. So one thing that the UK needs to do is actually focus on, you know, using AI, getting the value, creating the conditions to, you know, extract value from artificial intelligence systems, to realize that this isn't going to be as easy as just sort of throwing money at a model, but it's going to require sort of substantial changes to business processes, to infrastructure. You know, one example I like to give is that the UK policing system is built in 1974, roughly. There was an effort to modernize it. I think the cost has gone from 600 billion to 1.1, or sorry, 600 million to 1.1 billion, probably won't be finished on time. So to even get to a point where the country is able to sort of fully extract value from AI, the funding needs to match. That hasn't happened yet. And then the other part of this equation is that a lot of the algorithmic systems or AI-based systems that they're talking about that are sort of cutting edge, state of the art, these all run on American infrastructure. They're owned by American companies. They're paid for with American capital. That will take some time for sort of European and you know, other global actors to get around. And I'm not sure how they're going to do that. But obviously, the AI Safety Summit has had some initial success thus far in getting people to the table and having some discussions around, you know, frontier safety, you know, the safety of frontier models. But looking at how things are playing out in the States, I'm not sure whether or not that will be viable in the long run.
Keegan, thanks for joining us today. That's Keegan McBride from the Oxford Internet Institute. I actually reported something online. It was a deep fake I saw on social media. I won't blame a certain company. I reported it. It was definitely a deep fake, and they rebuffed it. They told me they weren't going to
not interested.
It. No, not interested.
Ah, very interesting.
So I thought that was pretty surprising because it was clearly fake.
Yeah, I mean, well done you for spotting it. But this could be something, of course, we may be seeing more of as we've been talking about. Well, let's turn to the Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, now, who's been taking part in a phone-in show on LBC Radio, covering topics ranging from the war in the Middle East to his plan to deport failed asylum seekers to Rwanda. James Wilcock was listening in to the programme and he joins us now for more. James, why would a Prime Minister agree to do a show like this?
Not a Prime Minister, Stephen. Rishi Sunak, why would Rishi Sunak agree to go on a phone-in programme? The answer is quite simply, there are local elections coming up and Sunak is seen as unpopular and unwieldy and difficult to talk to with the normal people. So the reason why you go on a phone-in programme is to show that you're capable of handling difficult questions and that, frankly, you're a normal human being. That's why you do it. And so the question, in some ways, is almost not so much what is said about policy, but how human do you come across?
And just answer that question, did he come across as a human? How did he do on the policy issues?
Can I be brutally honest with you? You like brutal honesty.
Be brutal,
on the podcast.
Be brutal.
The only thing you need to know about this half an hour phone in is a woman from the Rhondda called Louise rang in and said, good morning, Prime Minister. And Rishi Sunak goes, hi, Rhondda. And I'm afraid that is all that you will find on social media, and that is all that will be written about this interview, is that there was a fumble. And it feels a bit mean to say this, that in half an hour that talked about, you know, Rwanda, defence policy, shoplifting, there are all these other things that we could seriously talk about, but this is meant to demonstrate what Rishi is like on the campaign trail and show that he's good, and it was a slip. It was a minor slip. It's a slip feels a bit bad to make a big deal about, but...
And he did correct himself quite quickly, didn't he? But the trouble is, once that clip's out there...
This is the social media age. This is why politicians are so cagey about doing some media, I'm afraid, because... these things go viral.
Everything comes back to the internet again. Curmudgeon's Corner has re-emerged. There were some substantive issues, as you mentioned, James, that were tackled in this as well. Some comments on the Prime Minister's plan to try and be able to deport asylum seekers to Rwanda.
I think if you're Rishi Sunak, the things that you need to prove and the things you need to hope for, right? And so, you need to try and prove that you're a personable person. That is what the polls say. The Conservatives have gone down in 20 points. The story of Rishi Sunak's prime ministership is, if you look at, say, YouGov polling, when he started, October 2022, 28% of people thought he was doing a bad job. 45% didn't know. Now, 69% of people think he's doing a bad job. So, like, look, one interview appearance is not going to turn around, like, 2 years of trendline polling and thoughts. What you need to show, he thinks, is Keir Starmer's doing something badly. Big mess up from Starmer. That's the big thing. So, yeah, when Keir Starmer does an LBC call, it's like, well, is he going to get the Rhondda sort of trick wrong? And will that go viral? Two is he hopes the economy will get better. And that's, and his five pledges, Stephen, form kind of the core of this interview, where he wants to talk about the idea that his five priorities are still going, that Rwanda is still happening, stop the boat, and that is what he hopes people will change their mind about on him. The idea that these five pledges are what people care about. He wants them to think that, and he also wants to think that he is achieving them, and he will continue to achieve them if he wins the next general election. And in that, that's why the Rwanda president, Paul Kagame, is visiting today. In some ways, it's as much about Sunak's PR as it is about his PR. And so I think that's what he's trying to sort of build this election campaign, both local and election campaign, on. It's this idea that he is achieving what the people want. And I will put a question mark over that, because he got to announce his five pledges. They weren't asked for by the general public.
Okay. James, thank you for stepping in for us. That's James Wilcock from outside the office. James, thanks so much for giving us your thoughts on that. That's Bloomberg's James Wilcock.
Well, that's it from us for today. If you like the programme, don't forget to subscribe and give it 5 stars so other people can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
This episode was produced by Tiwa Adebayo, and our audio engineer was Sean Rustamakia. I'm Ewan Potts.
And I'm Stephen Carroll. We'll be back with more tomorrow. This is Bloomberg.
Bloomberg UK Politics. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox president Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.